Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning. Welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the web, 989fm.com.au, or on the podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. It's great to have your company here this morning. Sadly, another death in custody. Up in Darwin in the Northern Territory, the prisoner was on remand, so hadn't been charged yet. 31-year-old man who's passed away, and very scarce details coming out of Darwin. It's also an election in the Northern Territory tomorrow, so I wonder if that'll play any part in tomorrow's polls. I'm not sure if it will, but we've got to keep our pressure on as well. But saying that, today my guest is Martin Hodgson, who is part of the Foreign Prisoner Support Service, but is also a UN man, heavily involved in a lot of death penalty cases over in the US, which he says will have ramifications of how we look at the potentially many prisoners, Aboriginal prisoners, who could be locked up across the country and who are actually innocent. So he's been on the program before and hopefully will be a regular guest. I spoke to him yesterday. Here's my chat with Martin. Martin, thank you for joining me on the program again.
Good morning, Amy. How are you going?
Yeah, going good. But how are you going?
Very busy. There's so much going on with all the cases we're managing at the moment. A lot of good news, but a lot of bad news too. So it's busy, it's hectic, but we never stop and we don't want to stop working for our clients.
Yeah, that's great. Can I start by asking you a bit about your mob and your country and where you're from?
Yeah, you and mob living down at the moment on Jerringanj country, and it's a beautiful time of the year because we've got the whales and their calves in the bays at the moment, and the old people had a very strong connection to the whaling industry and pre-invasion and colonisation had a very close relationship with the killer whales, and some people might know about the stories of the killer whales in Eden. So it's a beautiful time of year down here, and we're very lucky.
It's really interesting as well. Did any of that sort of, because I know a lot of that knowledge in the past was lost in the relationships between the orcas and local Yuin mob down there. Was there anything, you know, that any sort of continuation in relation to those stories and those relationships with the orca, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's really coming back, a lot of that stuff. I think as we're seeing a greater interest from the wider community in protecting whales more broadly, that we're seeing an interest in this ongoing connection that mob had to whales, but particularly the killer whales. And so with that, there's been a lot of historians looking at it. We've got the Killer Whale Museum down here, and there's definitely more interest from the broader community in Indigenous knowledge around this issue, particularly with climate change being such a big issue and the issue of whale migration. Nobody is better placed than the local mob to explain when the whales arrived, when they calved, because that's what brought the killer whales to the area. So I think we're seeing the broader community finally understand that the history, the knowledge and the connection that mob had is a really vital part in telling the story of what's happening to our globe at the moment.
Oh, most definitely. We could end up talking for another hour about that in itself. But last time you were on, we were talking about the case, a death penalty case over in America in relation to Rodney Reed, who's currently on death row over the murder of a young woman, 19-year-old white woman in 1998 or around that time. Can you tell me a little bit about just a brief summary of that case, just for our listeners who may not have heard about it, heard our last conversation?
Yeah, sure. So Rodney was basically the only African-American man in a very small country town in Texas. and the fiancée of a police officer was found murdered, and she was found dead on the side of the road. And the police bungled the investigation, and after a year, they finally came around to charge Rodney with virtually no evidence, and he was convicted and sentenced to death. And over the years, we've been able to establish a huge amount of DNA evidence to show that there was no evidence attaching him to the crime itself. But more importantly, there was evidence to show that the fiancé of the young woman, who was a police officer himself, was involved. And that police officer, the fiancé, would go on later to be convicted of kidnapping another woman. So he's definitely got a bad record. Mm. And there's been a lot of police cover-up, a lot of police interference. So the officers... Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, no, you keep going, yeah.
Yeah, who investigated the case were the fiancé's neighbour and best friend. So, the cards were really stacked against Rodney, and the final nail in his conviction was that a psychiatrist, who's become known as Dr. Death, said that Rodney definitely did it and was a psychopath and a danger to the community. And that psychiatrist has gone on to be proven to be a complete liar, a fraud. He's been stripped of all his qualifications, but unfortunately he's been involved in almost every death penalty case in Texas.
God.
And 20 years later we're still fighting for Rodney and trying to get him out.
Was there any reason why that particular psychiatrist was always called upon? I can guess why the prosecution would always drag that particular psychiatrist out, because they knew they were going to get a certain finding from him?
Yeah, exactly. We see that in almost every state that has the death penalty in America, that you end up with the exact same psychiatrist and the exact same forensic experts always being called by the prosecution. So in another case that I'm working on at the moment, we've actually had a big win. In the last week, a gentleman who was convicted under the law of parties, which we spoke about briefly last time, where he was not involved in a murder. He would just happen to be in the car that the murderer used to get to the crime. And it, again, same psychiatrist as Rodney's, and said that this client, Jeff Wood, was also a psychopath.
Was he African-American as well?
No, Jeff's white. Initially, the first judge refused to hear the case because Jeff has a very, very low IQ. So he has quite serious mental illnesses. He was unfit to stand trial. He didn't understand what was happening to him, and that was how this particular criminal was able to use Jeff in that robbery that turned, unfortunately, into a murder. But Jeff wasn't at the actual scene itself. But what Jeff and Rodney share is the same psychiatrist, this Dr. Death. And in the win we've had this week, which will help Rodney, is that it turns out that this Dr. Death never examined Jeff.
Wow.
So he said that he was a psychopath and deserving of the death penalty. This is a man who never murdered anyone, and the police don't contest that either. But he never interviewed him, never spoke to him personally, never saw his medical records, but was convinced that this was a psychopath who should be put to death.
Why a psychopath? I mean, what sort of criteria has to make up a psychopath, and why do you think that particular psychiatrist was so keen to brand so many people with that?
Well, I think it's what gives juries often a license to hand down the death penalty. So we see in many, many cases where we've been able to have convictions overturned and prove, in some cases, that the alleged killer was not even in the same state. These are people who have no criminal records but have ended up spending 20 years inside before we were able to have their death penalty convictions overturned. So I think the label of psychopath is a very strong and impactful statement upon the jury and often leads to a conviction. So I think that's why he constantly rolled it out. And it's a very, very rare condition. We have, I think, a misunderstanding in the broader community that a lot of people are capable of this sort of psychiatric disorder, and it's very, very rare.
Mm.
And but because the general community right around the world believe it to be more prominent than it actually is, believe it to be incurable, and believe these psychiatrists over anyone else, even when they haven't examined the individual, it makes it so much easier for them to then hand down these very harsh sentences and believe the prosecution's claims, even when there's very little evidence.
It really overshadows a lot of stuff about what actually causes crime too, and what might make a murderer into a murderer. You know what I mean? It really overshadows what might have happened in people's lives, and that maybe not everyone is actually born bad, that things happen to them in the lead up, and or it overshadows the need for maybe mitigating circumstances that doesn't include the death penalty. I guess it sort of strips away any hope of sympathy for the perpetrator.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is another important aspect of why the prosecution call on these experts who have a record of just labelling someone a psychopath, because what we see, whether it's Indigenous people in Australia or African Americans in the prison system in America, where there's vast overrepresentation, is that clearly with this vast overrepresentation, we have a huge number of innocent people.
Mm.
And one of the ways you get an innocent person locked up is to strip them of their history of trauma and strip them of their humanity, which enables a jury or a judge to empathise with that trauma. And then you can selectively pick some few bad experiences or actions in that person's life and make them paint the picture of the person, rather than understanding the full history of the trauma of an individual and, more broadly, the community they come from. And what we see is that not only do you see the over-criminalisation of people who have committed minor crimes, you see the dramatic criminalisation of completely innocent people, so much so that they end up on death row, and it's a huge, huge problem.
It was really interesting because if you're talking about how the jury sees them as psychopaths, and you think of Rodney, African-American, this other fellow who must be obviously from a lower class. I mean, I think the biases just throughout society would play into that perception, when really you look at the history of psychopaths and serial killers in America, a lot of them are white men, and I can imagine well-to-do men, aren't they? So it really, the bias is completely unfounded as well, but I guess it just adds to the case of that these men, it can automatically believed that they are psychopaths.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the jury goes in obviously not understanding a lot of that. And so then it's very easy for a psychiatrist, particularly one who is dodgy and working for the state, to use big terms to not really tell the true story and convince them that this is the case. And one thing we do know is that most true psychopaths have very high IQ, functioning IQs, who often do function fairly well in society in many ways. Their condition often doesn't ever present for the most part in their lives. Some will never be diagnosed or even treated. There's been a number of studies that show that many of the CEOs involved in the global financial crisis at the very least had sociopathic tendencies. Mm. So we're talking people with hundreds of millions of dollars. Right. But in the case of both Rodney, who had very little money, an African-American gentleman in an all-white town who was accused of the murder of the fiancée of a local police officer, he had no chance going in. And then to have this label placed on him that was just completely untrue, of course, played a huge role in his conviction. And then with Jeff, who you rightly say was from a lower socioeconomic situation, who has an IQ far, far below that of an average citizen. I mean, we're talking closer to a nine-year-old's functioning ability. And then to label him a psychopath goes against everything we know about criminal socio and psychopaths. And yet the jury is never informed of any of this. So it's a very convenient and clever way that they use when they just don't have any other information or evidence because these people didn't commit the crimes, to strip them of their humanity and make it very easy to hand out the harshest sentences possible.
Wouldn't it have been easy for the defence to sort of pull apart a lot of those claims, though, if they were cross-examining that psychiatrist, or is it a case of that they didn't have very good defence in the first place?
Yeah, so we see that if you have someone like, we take O.J. Simpson, someone who had, I think, the best legal team ever assembled, they would have destroyed this psychiatrist in a matter of minutes, and it would have been made a total farce. But with both Jeff and Rodney needing legal aid, both their initial lawyers did a disgraceful job, barely challenged any evidence at all, and most of the evidence, the forensic evidence, including from this psychiatrist, went completely unchallenged. And so that goes to the broader class issue, that when you're relying on public defenders in the United States or legal aid in Australia, you just don't have the finances to call an expert to counter those claims, because it can cost thousands and thousands of dollars per day just to have the right expert to challenge those claims. So we're not really seeing justice. We're not seeing fair trials. We're seeing the power of the state and all the money they can bring to a prosecution up against the very limited resources that are available to poor people.
It's incredibly unfair, isn't it? It's not a justice system at all. It's all about money.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what we see is that, I mean, the old saying in America is about capital punishment is if you don't have the capital, you get the punishment.
Mm.
And so it really is all about money. There's certainly nothing about the truth in these matters. So if we're seeking to find out what really happened and get justice for the victims, I think what people need to remember is every time we send an innocent man or woman to prison, the victim gets no justice, and we still have the real killer out in society. So there's really three crimes committed by these prosecutors who know the person's not guilty, by these psychiatrists who break all the professional codes of which they're supposed to uphold, who accuse these people they've never examined of being psychopaths. They condemn innocent men to death. They provide no justice to the victims and their families, and they subject the community to the very real possibility that the real killer will go free and will commit a crime again. And so we're left in a really unacceptable situation that delivers no justice to anyone and certainly exposes no truth about what happened in the case or in the lives of any of these people affected.
And what's happening to Jeff now in relation to his case?
Well, in recent weeks, since we spoke last, we've had wins for both Jeff and Rodney. Now, both Jeff and Rodney are in Texas, and both have been in prison for about 20 years each.
Are they in the same death row, same place or different?
They were held at the same place. They do know each other. Jeff is in a different prison at the moment, although there is a chance, actually, that they will be back together in the same unit. So in Jeff's case, he was, up until a couple of days ago, facing the death penalty, and he would have been executed this morning at 6 a.m.
Wow, that's very scary when you consider that.
Yeah, so Jeff, an innocent man, would no longer be with us because the state of Texas would have taken his life. But Friday we managed to get a win, and not only was the court very disturbed by the evidence this particular psychiatrist had given in Jeff's case, that he'd never been examined and he'd been labelled a psychopath. They were also very disturbed, obviously, about putting to death a man who the police admit never killed anybody. So, you know, this is a disgraceful situation. And that also that there was a great deal of forensic misdeed done by the forensic examiners who examined the case. So not only did they give Jeff a stay so that the execution wouldn't go ahead, they've ordered that the case be sent back to the appeals court and that we get another chance to prove his innocence. And that's very rare.
Wow.
Generally, when they issue a stay, it's simply to buy maybe 3 more months before an execution might go ahead. And it just really gives the Board of Pardons and Paroles more time to ensure they're happy with everything that's going to go ahead. But now Jeff's he's not going to get a new trial, but he is going to get a chance to have this evidence that should have been presented at his initial trial put before a court. And now that we've got a good legal team assembled, I think we've got a really good chance for Jeff. And the way this affects Rodney is that, of course, they were both convicted largely on the evidence of this same psychiatrist, so that the precedent was set on Friday that, again, yet again, this psychiatrist has been proven to be, I mean, quite frankly, a terrible, terrible individual, and not a psychiatrist at all, just a disgrace. And so that has enabled the courts to allow Jeff access to what we call post-conviction relief and more post-conviction relief, because he's already used that in the past. So now his local lawyer will be able to present more evidence on his behalf, and we're hoping we'll be able to present new DNA evidence that proves Rodney didn't commit the crime. So we're talking about a black man and a white man, both in prison for more than 20 years for crimes they didn't do, and this is the link they share, is a very corrupt judicial system suffering very poor representation because of their class and their lack of money, and convicted largely on phony evidence and a corrupt and a disgraceful psychiatrist.
It seems like the process is very traumatizing as well, because you did mention to me just this idea of having to try and, you know, get your stay of execution as time is running out before they want to kill you, effectively. That's a form of torture in itself, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, Jeff was counting down the days, so we got very close. As I said, Jeff would be no longer with us, so we'd all made our final phone calls. Jeff would have had access to a phone up until just before he was executed, but we try and leave that, obviously, just for the family. So we'd all sent our final goodbyes. Jeff's someone I've known for 14 years.
Wow.
So, and this is not the first time for Jeff. I think this is something else people need to understand, that Jeff might have come 5 days within his death this time, but he's come within 5 hours previously. And so he's eaten his final meal before. He's made final calls. And he's been held in the cell where you're just metres away from the gurney they strap you to. And he's had to sit and wait. And then the phone rings. And it's from a court giving him a stay. So this has happened to him a number of times over many years. And it's what we call a mock execution. And it's one of the greatest forms of torture known to man. And we have to remember that this is a gentleman with an IQ of 70. So as I say, his functioning is about the level of a grade 3 individual. God. And he's been subjected to this multiple times. And it means that when this is done, the day before the person is taken from their cell, and in Texas they're driven from one prison unit to another, and it's a bit over an hour, and they're shackled, and the masks are often used, as we saw on Four Corners, the spit masks. So it's a very traumatic process. It's very hard to explain to people who haven't had to witness what happens, but it's a process that takes days and often weeks. And so the person has virtually no sleep. They don't eat. Their children, their families have to say their goodbyes. They're not allowed any physical contact with anyone, not even the prison guards. Just one guard will be assigned to actual contact. So it's a very dehumanising and traumatic process.
Oh, God, it's absolutely horrendous. It doesn't, I think a lot of people like to think that, you know, it's a lot better process now, that it might just be, you know, a needle in the arm and then you slowly die, and that it's a lot more humane than when they were hanging, you know, putting nooses around people's necks. But it's not really that much different when you consider the psychological torture that people have to go through, I guess. We're not much different from the past.
No, we haven't changed. No, I think the lethal injection has been another case. It's sort of like the use of psychiatrists now to condemn someone as being a psychopath, and that there's no chance of rehabilitation and that they must have done it. It's sort of a sanitising of the process. It's designed to make it very easy for the community to accept. And the lethal injection is another way. Executing someone by firing squad with a noose, these are very messy executions. And the idea that is given to the community is that the lethal injection, it's just like having your dog put down at the vet and it all goes very peacefully. But the average time of death from once the needle is placed in and the first drug is administered is 22 minutes. And often the lethal injection is botched, particularly in Texas.
In fact, it has been before, where a man didn't die from it and they had to re-execute him.
Yeah, that's right. And we've had cases where people have taken up to an hour to die, often in tremendous pain. But a lot of the drug companies now, because they're from Europe, who doesn't have the death penalty, refuse to supply to the United States. So what we're seeing is compounding pharmacists being employed by Texas and Oklahoma and other states to come up with new drugs that have never been used before. So we don't even know what will happen. So this is another thing that people have to remember is racing through Jeff and Rodney's mind every time they come within hours of execution, is all they've heard is that the person in the cell next to them, who they've spent 20 years with on death row, was executed recently and their skin melted off them because of the drugs used to execute them, that they screamed in pain and that it often didn't work. We've had prisoners catch fire because of these drugs. I mean, there's a very good reason they have blinds in the room so that they can prevent the public gallery and the media from seeing what's going on.
What goes wrong?
Yeah, and it's used quite regularly. And we've heard through the microphones people screaming out in pain. We have to remember too that for the most part, doctors now have refused to take part because, of course, it goes against the basic Hippocratic oath of do no harm. You're putting to death someone who may or may not be innocent. So we have untrained prison guards putting these needles in, and often they miss the vein completely, which means that these highly toxic chemicals are injected straight into the muscle, into the skin, into the body cavity, and so they don't actually kill the person, they just administer horrific pain and injury to the person. And it's traumatic for everyone involved. I think it's absolutely disgraceful that a rich state, a supposed first world country, would ask prison guards, who themselves are often people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds who are being paid disgracefully low wages to kill someone.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, you'd feel horrible, you'd feel like you've got blood on your hands to be actually doing the state-sanctioned murder.
Absolutely, and some of the best advocates against the death penalty that we have today are the very prison guards who have executed people themselves. Because the trauma that they're exposed to when an execution goes wrong, the trauma they're exposed to when someone is proven to be innocent after their death, knowing they were the one that put the needle in the arm of a man who did no crime, who did no wrong. There's only been one murder, and that was them murdering that innocent person who just spent 20 years on death row. And often these guards have worked for that time or longer in the prison. So they have built a relationship with the prisoner as well. And to then find out that they were the one that actually killed an innocent man is a terrible, terrible burden for the state to put on an individual. And we see in states that do have the death penalty, of course, a large percentage of suicide amongst the prison guards who are involved in death row work. So there's no winners from this system. And any time you're executing innocent men, you condemn everybody involved. And we have to find better ways, whether it's in Australia where we don't have the death penalty, but we send innocent men to prison for the rest of their lives based on no evidence at all, or in America where we traumatise whole communities as well by executing innocent people, or executing people who might have done it, but who, for a variety of reasons, were not given the trial they deserved, where there are extenuating circumstances. There's no winners here. And what we're constantly being able to prove is that the harsher treatment you subject prisoners to, whether it's shackling them, whether it's hooding them, as we've seen in the Northern Territory, whether it's the death penalty, places that treat prisoners in this way have higher crime levels.
Yeah, and I think that's been shown. I mean, crime isn't really, I don't know the full national statistics, but I can imagine it hasn't really changed that much. In fact, I think crime's gone down in Australia, but the number of people we lock up has gone higher and higher, and most of them blackfellas as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, one thing we're seeing is that the criminalisation of communities of lower class, of particularly in Australia, obviously, of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, is horrendous. So in New South Wales, crime has gone down considerably. But we have the spectacle at the moment of crime figures reducing and the corrective services minister saying he's going to increase the number of prison cells by 33%. Well, if crime's going down, why do we need more cells? It can only be to lock up more people who either A, have committed no crime at all, or whose crimes are so minor that they should not be in prison at all. So one thing that's just come out in New South Wales in an ombudsman's report is that for people found intoxicated in public, the vast bulk obviously are given a move on direction. So basically you're told to go home. But 37% of those who are apprehended and taken to custody for being intoxicated in public are Aboriginal people, despite being just 5% of the population.
And we just saw that recently with the death in custody down in Maitland. The woman, Rebecca Maher, supposedly picked up because she was out on the street, apparently intoxicated, is what the police said. So that's a case in point just there.
Yeah, absolutely. And unlike Victoria, that has a law where public intoxication is technically illegal, and it gives the police the right to either issue an on-the-spot fine or take the person into custody, even if they're simply only a danger to themselves. In New South Wales, no actual law on the criminalisation of public intoxication exists. What really happens is a failure to comply with a police direction, which is a move-on direction. But in Miss Maher's case, we don't know if she was ever given a move-on direction. What we do know, however, is that her death is completely class-based. And people say, how can you prove it? Well, very easily, based on the police's own guidelines that they brought in under the new lockout laws, which was their way of gaining more power to deal with intoxicated people. The way I would say that Miss Maher was targeted, and because of who she is as an Indigenous woman and the fact we know that Indigenous people, by their own statistics, are overwhelmingly targeted, 37% when just 5% of the population. I mean, by their own stats, they are targeting Indigenous people. But it's a class issue. Miss Maher was walking. Had she been in a cab, they wouldn't have been able to pick her up. In fact, I'll read from the New South Wales Police's own guidelines for the CBD of Sydney for people who are intoxicated. Free buses from King's Cross and the CBD will be provided under the night ride services on Fridays and Saturday nights. Free buses.
Yeah.
Well, why wasn't Miss Maher given a free ride home?
She was out in Maitland, or she was out in Cessnock at the time.
Yeah. So why is there one rule for those who can afford to go out in King's Cross or the CBD of Sydney, and another rule for people in rural and regional New South Wales? Why do we provide a free bus service for those living in Sydney, where you have to have, for the most part, a much larger amount of money than you would need to live in, say, Maitland or anywhere else in regional Australia? So her crime was that she walked. If she'd got on a bus where they're not free in Maitland, for the most part, in regional Australia, we have no public transport, so we are forced to walk. It deliberately targets people of a lower socioeconomic background, because most of the people who go out in the city can afford to Uber it or taxi it home. The only crime Miss Maher committed was not having the funds that other people are given to get a taxi home. And for those who can't, they are given, paid for by the New South Wales government, from Miss Maher's tax dollars and my tax dollars, a free bus ride home. And these are people who are intoxicated and who are breaking the lockout laws that only apply to the CBD of Sydney.
Yeah.
Miss Maher was not in an area where those lockout laws apply. She committed no crime, and yet she's dead. And I want to know why someone hasn't been charged. I don't want to hear about people talking about making phone calls or why we need to have more liaison officers.
Yeah.
This doesn't work. She's committed no crime. She should not be traumatised by being arrested by police. Well, she wasn't arrested. Technically, she wasn't arrested. She was taken into custody. Why should she have to go to a police cell and before she gets help?
Yeah.
Everyone else, as their own guidelines say, as is on the New South Wales Police's website if they're in King's Cross, the CBD. Drunk as anything gets a free bus ride home.
Yeah, and it's what frustrates me as well when you talk about the fact the lockout laws, they were largely sort of pushed by, you know, the alcoholic-fueled violence within the cities of Sydney, but it ultimately ends up impacting people in regional and rural areas more, a lot of these sort of tightening of laws as well. So, you know, there's just a sort of concentration on the metropolitan areas where all of the media areas, really all the attention is always, and they have no understanding of what it's actually going to be like and how it's going to impact people. And particularly, you know, more vulnerable people, like obviously Ms. Ma was an Aboriginal woman from a lower socioeconomic area. So there's no understanding of that and no even talk about it. And the other thing that frustrates me, as you said, was the narrative around, you know, even if she was in that police cell, they should have called the ALS of this, as if this could have actually might have changed anything. You know what I mean? It just seems to be on one little part of what happened rather than looking at the greater issues as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. And when the first report, I mean, everything you just said is not only true, it's been confirmed by the New South Wales Ombudsman, who did the first report in 2014 into these new laws. And again, I'll quote, he said that not only have these laws affected people outside the CBD, where the only place, that was the only place they were supposed to be introduced, they've been rolled out by the police across New South Wales. And this is what he said. The decriminalisation mechanisms have had and continue to have a disproportionately coercive and punitive impact on Aboriginal people in New South Wales. So that's a quote from the Ombudsman looking at the laws, and that was in 2014. And the punitive impact on Miss Ma is that she's dead, and the punitive impact on her family is that she died in police custody for no reason when she should never have been in police custody. In fact, under these laws, if she'd been well off enough to be drinking in the CBD at a fancy nightclub, she would have got a free bus ride home.
There
is no place. This idea, and I think it's very important, because how does someone like Rodney end up in prison in the United States for a murder he didn't commit? It's because he's been criminalised over a great deal of his life. And how does that start, whether it's in America or in Australia? It's generally by being picked up walking home at night. That's often black people in Australia or in America's first contact with the police. Often when we're 13 or 14, what are you doing?
Walking while black, pretty much. That's what you've been doing.
Walking while black. I mean, the joke is driving while black, but when you're a kid, you don't, obviously you're not driving yet, and you're walking. Or for people who don't have cars, or in Miss Ma's case, doing the right thing, we're told, if you've been drinking, don't drive. Lock up your car and go home. So how are you supposed to do that in an area that has no public transport?
Yeah.
In an area that has no taxi service? You walk. Well, we've all done it. Now, not only is it not a crime, she's doing what's being asked of her by the very law that then finds her dead the next morning in one of their cells. And to victim blame her, to say that she shouldn't have been out, so we've got lockout laws that convict anyone who's outside of their home at 6 p.m. Drinking is perfectly legal. The New South Wales government makes a huge profit on alcohol consumption. So what we're saying is that there's really two rules. One says if you've got money, you can go out and have a great time in Sydney. If you're really drunk and you're told to leave a club, you'll be given a move on direction and you can get on the free bus and go home. Or if you don't follow that, then maybe the police might come and intervene. But if you're a black fella, particularly in the outer suburbs or in regional rural New South Wales, you're now a criminal.
Yeah.
And this is disgraceful. And the victim blaming that goes on, that anyone who is picked up for this, Indigenous people who are picked up for this, to say that, why did they find themselves in this situation? They've done nothing wrong.
No, they haven't at all.
To say that we need even a CNS is to say that actually the police can't be trusted. They kill too many blackfellas. So we need a number to be called, and if it's not called, a person might die, a blackfella
might
die.
That's not the narrative that they use to justify pushing for it, and I think what they use is in case the blackfella is going to suicide. I think that's they are pushing, and I guess that's because the ALS are so hampered for government funds. And you saw it, that narrative, in the recent project, monologue by Waleed Ali, who took very good care to preface his criticism by saying, we're not saying the police murder anyone. We're not saying the prisons kill people. What we're saying is this, but then goes on to be very contradictory and talk about a death penalty inside. So it's very contradictory. People are just skirting around the edges, rather than just saying what's actually happening.
Yeah, and so the big lie is that it's done for the person's own well-being. Well, why don't they treat Indigenous people like everyone else?
And shouldn't there be a CNS for everyone then?
And either we need one or we don't. Because to say we need one is an admission that blackfellas are not safe in the custody of the police. So how is that Miss Maher's fault in any way? And I really take issue with both what Waleed Ali said and the whole narrative around what's been written in the mainstream media, and just even more broadly, that anything that can be put into place to assist someone like Miss Maher in a situation like that should be done. No, what should be done is she should never have been arrested in the first place. And I'm absolutely sick to death of black people having to be first traumatised and criminalised before anyone even considers that they should be given one phone call, which is not made by them anyway. The police called the CNS line.
But they don't have to. The other thing is, the police actually don't have to, because they hadn't charged her with anything. So there's nothing in the legislation that actually forces them to call the CNS hotline in the first place.
No, and they don't have to, and you have to assume that not only do they not have to, but that when they've done something wrong, they're not going to.
Yeah.
Why would they dob themselves in? So we don't know, and we'll find out, I'm sure, at some point, that probably the reason they didn't call the line is that Miss Maher's condition deteriorated very rapidly upon them placing her inside a cell. And so the last thing they want to do is make a phone call where they'd be dobbing themselves in as to the condition of someone in their care and custody.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do in King's Cross or the CBD again is, if someone is so intoxicated to the point of being either a danger to themselves or their own health, an ambulance is called. We have ambulances in the CBD on standby for such situations.
Mm.
Because if you're so sick you're about to die, you don't belong in a police cell.
Yeah.
A police cell that we've seen in cells and correctional services have killed more than 400 blackfellas in Australia in 25 years. That is definitely not the right place for the person to be.
Definitely not.
They should be in a hospital bed. Or, if there's nothing wrong with them and they've committed no crime, because in Miss Maher's case she hadn't been charged, and in almost all these cases the person hasn't been charged, they should be at home.
Yep.
Where they have every right to be, where they were generally walking to or going, when the police decided, for reasons that have yet to be explained or justified, are detaining someone and depriving them of their liberty for no other reason than they're black. And we know that because their own figures admit they do it to 37% of people in all these situations, when we make up just 5% of the state. So I would rather see the focus be on the police. Mm. I would rather see the focus be on the cowardly and gutless politicians who bring in these laws that enable it to happen. When is a journalist going to put a microphone in front of Mike Baird and ask him how many people have died in police cells because of these new laws?
It's very... keep going.
He can talk about saving lives and law and order, and that's all great to win in an election. We also need to remember he's doing this and saying this at the same time his corrective services minister is not only building new prisons, but having them built by private companies. So what does a prison need? It needs inmates. And to a company, they think of it like a hotel. And a prison is the perfect hotel for a company because the no vacancy sign is always out.
Mm. But you know what? That's not what the focus is on. It's on police cells, isn't it? So they've completely erased any aspect of prisons and the fact that blackfellas are really dying in prisons, over the course of since 2000, regardless of what the common narrative has been. So the focus hasn't been on prisons at all. They've really narrowed it down to police cells.
Well, again, that's the big lie. We see today reports of another death in custody in Australia.
Up in Darwin,
up in the NT, a 31-year-old, and he was on remand.
So not charged yet, eh?
Not charged. So now under what the big narrative that's been rolled out is that it hasn't happened in a police cell in New South Wales. Well, someone on remand, whether they're charged yet or not, or whether they're awaiting trial, or we're waiting for the police to finalise their reports, or prosecutors to decide what's going to progress, they go before a judge, the bail's denied, and inside they go. Now, technically, it's not a police cell. It's a prison cell.
Yeah.
Well, you tell me the difference to anyone who's living inside that cell.
Yeah.
I've been to them all. They all look the same to me.
Yeah.
And the trauma that is caused to the people inside them is exactly the same. So people can run this false line that there's been one for 16 years, since the year 2000, and it's the biggest lie I've ever heard, and it's used to cover up the death of blackfellas whose death have never been investigated.
And I would include also the death just a couple of years ago now, 5 or 6 years ago, Mark Mason, who was shot by cops in Coleraine. So technically he wasn't in a police cell, but he was still in custody effectively. He had five cops around him and they shot him. One of them shot him. So it really is a lie, isn't it? It's totally erases so many black deaths.
It is a complete lie, and his death, there is still huge question marks, as you know.
Oh, totally, yeah.
What happened there, and I would 100% agree with you that he was in the process of being placed in police custody, so it's exactly the same. We do know that in New South Wales and the ACT, where the CNS operates, and that those figures were drawn from, that there's actually been more than 10 deaths in custody in that time. Some of them due to quite clear criminal negligence by corrective services and the police. We see in the ACT where an Indigenous gentleman was bashed to death. Well, the prison services were aware of threats to his life.
Yeah.
His family had made reports about it.
They're in the media before he was killed. I'm pretty sure I heard reading about him.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And I think, what I was going to say is it was basically, you're right, it was in the media. And worse than that, it was known to everyone in the community. So the idea that corrective services and the police didn't know is just a lie.
Yeah.
So I refuse to sit here and accept the narrative that there's been just one death in 16 years, because what that says is the death of everyone else we've spoken about, at least the other 10, including Mr. Mason, is erased. It means that their deaths will never be investigated. It means their families will never get justice. And it also sends a message to the community, one in 16 blackfellas every 16 years, they can live with that.
Yeah.
Because
or just give them a few dollars for the CNS.
Yeah, we'll
keep locking them up.
chuck a bit of money here, and that's okay. But what we're not, by spinning that narrative, we are not telling the truth, which is what every black fella knows, that it's not one in 16 years. It happens all the time.
Yeah. That was Amy McGuire with Let's Talk.